Welcome to Whiskey Cast, the Cask Strength podcast featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 224 for October 31st, 2009. Coming up in a few minutes.
It's a blend, and therefore there's a lot of different types of flavors in there. But when comparing that to some other malts, are not one-dimensional. I'm not meaning that at all. But they're just a small facet of what goes into a blend. But some people really like to focus on that facet.
That's Keith Law, one of the master blenders at Diageo, responsible for Buchanan's blended scotch, along with the Johnny Walker line. More with Keith in a few minutes, along with the weekly special from Park Avenue Liquor Shop in New York City. And the What I'm Tasting This Week department features Old Islas and a new bourbon. First, let's look at the news. There's a lot of whiskey consumed in England, but not much produced there. That's about to change as the English Whiskey Company's first spirit will hit the magic 3-year-old point in the next few weeks. You may recall Ian Henderson told us about St. George's Distillery back in episode 101 in July of 2007. He helped the Nelstrup family get their project off the ground. The first whiskey from St. George's will be available by Christmas, with a peated version coming next year. By the way, Andrew Nelstrup will be bringing the new whiskey to the Victoria Whiskey Festival at the end of January in British Columbia. Now, Jim Beam has been producing bourbon for more than 100 years, but the supplies of its Knob Creek bourbon dried up earlier this year. Knob Creek is the oldest bourbon Jim Beam produces at 9 years of age, and there weren't enough casks of 9-year-old bourbon in the rickhouses. Thursday, Jim Beam master distiller Fred Noe dumped the first barrels of 9-year-old Knob Creek to end the drought.
It was a huge day today at the plant here in Claremont. You can imagine, you know, the barrels have been waiting for this birthday party a lot of months, and we had bourbon that had gotten old enough to dump. So to be able to do it was a real cool experience, knowing that the drought of 2009 on Knob Creek has officially ended.
And it was, how long will it take to get this whiskey into the pipeline and get it out to stores?
I'd say it will be within 2 weeks. They'll be shipping cases at the latest, maybe sooner than that. Just depends, you know, today's Thursday, we've got dumped. There'll be, I would say a couple of weeks, there'll be cases available to be shipped, if not sooner.
What created the drought of 2009?
Actually, what created this drought was loyal consumers and fans of Knob Creek that drank the bourbon quicker than we could get it aged. What happened was, you know, we had, you know, aging at 9 years. You know, you're looking in a crystal ball, and 9 years ago we projected growth rates at, you know, 15%, which is pretty aggressive, and we had growth on Knob Creek at 20 to 30%. So all the extra barrels that we build in for each year got eaten up over these 9 years, and it grew faster than we could get it aged. And so, I mean, everybody's, you know, it was a problem, but I say it was a great problem because it just shows that we have loyal supporters of Knob Creek that are drinking it quicker than we can get it aged, which, you know, it's a crapshoot, you know, when you start looking at, you know, forecasting stuff 9 years from now. So we've, you know, that's essentially the problem, was our demand outgrew the supply. We could have compromised the Knob Creek and went to, you know, a younger age and not hold strong on our 9 years of age. But then we would have been, I think, compromising the product and the loyal people who support Knob Creek and wanted it 9 years of age. So we made a call that we're going to have a tough year, a very tight supply. Not going to have any barrels ready until today. We actually, I guess what you would call it, would be we dumped birthday whiskey, which is a bourbon that the day it turned the age, it came out of the barrel.
What steps are you guys taking to make sure this doesn't happen a few years down the road again?
We ramped up, you know, looking in our crystal ball, we've ramped up production, you know, of Knob Creek, laying down more barrels to age. And we're hoping that the supply of barrels we've been laying down, increasing incremental since we saw that our shots were a little low forecast. You know, growth has been bigger. That's all we can do is put down more barrels of Knob Creek. and hope we can keep up with the demand. And if it happens again, then our sales will be doing some tremendous jumping between now and 9 years from today.
Now, this is the oldest bourbon you guys release, right?
Yes, sir.
So that made the problem even more significant in that you didn't have anything else you could take out of storage to use for this.
Correct. Correct. I mean, and, you know, the Knob Creek, though, we couldn't really do that shifting from, say, a Jim Beam, because Knob Creek has the mash bill is different. The distillation proof is different. So in those two, if you were doing to keep it legitimate, we had to wait till the Knob Creek we made 9 years ago aged 9 years. We couldn't just move it or go out on the open market and buy some nine-year-old bourbon. I mean, that's always possible, but we weren't going to do that. We did not want to compromise the Knob Creek. Dad created this product, and that would have been the thing he would have wanted us to do. And so anything that I know how my dad thought is the way he did bourbon, and so we did not compromise the product that people love and drink at a pretty good clip. So we weren't definitely going to take any chances on changing what was inside of that bottle.
By the way, phase one of the new visitors center at the Jim Beam Distillery is complete now. The distillery is located in Claremont, Kentucky, just a couple of miles off Interstate 65, south of Louisville. Sticking with bourbon for a moment, Four Roses has kicked off a new single-barrel purchase program. Master distiller Jim Rutledge says barrel buyers now have two options to choose from.
One is our normal single barrel. It's got a grain recipe that uses more small flavoring grain by far than any other distillery. We have 60% corn, 35% rye, and 5% malted barley. We could actually add 16% rye grain, take that away from corn. We have a straight rye whiskey. A retail store can come in and select a barrel. Every barrel is different. Every barrel's in inventory, whether it be us, all the industry. There's no two barrels alike. Everyone's going to have their own fingerprint of flavor. So even though we have a single barrel program, all the barrels are slightly different. And so we have the program where a retailer can come in and select one of those recipes. Then we started just this year another program where the retailers or restaurants on-premise or off-premise accounts can come in and select one of the 10 recipes. And that will be bottled at barrel strength, and we won't run it through a chill filtering process. We'll run it through like a sock-type filter just to remove the charcoal, and it's the closest person can get to tasting a sample straight from the barrel. And that's an exciting program. And people, so far, it's amazing how many people from California to New York, Chicago, everywhere we go, people are interested in wanting to jump in and take part in that.
Details are available at the Four Roses website. There's a link at the WhiskeyCast website. Woodford Reserve has released its annual Master's Collection bourbon. This year's version is a seasoned oak release and used barrels made from wood left outside to season for 3 to 5 years to finish off already mature Woodford Reserve. I'll have more details on this one in an upcoming episode. In the last episode, I mentioned David Stewart's plans to scale back his schedule after 47 years at William Grant & Sons. The company is marking another anniversary this week for one of the few people who's been around even longer than David Stewart. Dennis McBain has been a coppersmith at the Balvenie for 50 years as of this week. He started back in 1959 when he was 17 years old and became the chief coppersmith in 1978. Congratulations, Dennis. We have three major whiskey auctions coming up in the next couple of weeks. McTeers in Glasgow will hold its fall auction on Wednesday. The lots include a 50-year-old Glenfiddich bottled in 1991, along with a bottle from the last cask ever filled at Dallas Dew before it closed in 1983. As I mentioned in the last episode, Christie's in New York will hold its annual wine and spirits auction on November 14th, with the Bowmore Trilogy set as the top item on the block. And finally, Bonhams in Edinburgh has its fall sale on the 18th of November. The highlight includes a one-of-a-kind Dalmore Oculus bottling. It was custom blended by Richard Patterson and includes Dalmore casks from as far back as 1868. Time now for the calendar of events brought to you by Laphroaig. This coming weekend is the Whiskey Show in London on November 6th and 7th, along with the Oslo Whiskey Festival in Norway and the Spirits in the Sky Festival in Leuven, Belgium. Tickets are sold out now for Malt Advocates Whiskey Fest in New York City on the 10th. The Philadelphia Whiskey Festival is November 12th, followed by the Pittsburgh Whiskey Festival the next night. The International Whiskey Festival and Whiskey Live are the 13th through the 15th in Leiden, the Netherlands. And the U.S. chapter of the Scotch Malt Whiskey Society's series of fall tastings continues on the 13th in Seattle, the 18th in San Francisco, and the 20th in Santa Monica, California. You'll find a complete calendar of events at the WhiskeyCast website, and it's brought to you by Laphroaig Quarter Cask. Just click on the Laphroaig banner at the WhiskeyCast website to become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Isla. Time now for our weekly chat with Jonathan Goldstein of Park Avenue Liquor Shop in New York. Jonathan, what have you got new this week?
Well, you know, we finally got in our Tuttletown-produced Park Avenue whiskey. It's 100% rye. It's fantastic. We've gotten very good feedback from it. It's $45 a bottle, and just look for it on our shelves if you come in. It's got blue lettering and a blue wax cap. We have also finally gotten in our Four Roses exclusive bottling. Also some very, very good feedback on that. I'm waiting to hear some reviews on that.
And that's out of the program that Jim Rutledge was talking about just a few minutes ago.
That's right. We also have the Elmer T. Lee 90th anniversary bottling, as well as the new Lagavulin Natural Cask Strength 12-year-old. The cask strength is 115.8 proof. That's $100 a bottle. Royal Lochnagar Select Reserve, bottled in 09. That comes in at $230 a bottle. And I think that does it since last time.
And what's the special for listeners this week?
For this week, we're going to do the Glenfiddich Rum Finish 21-year-old. Now, that's the U.S. version, the Caribbean rum finish, not the Havana rum finish, for obvious reasons. It was $135 a bottle on the shelf, and for everyone listening, it's $117 a bottle.
And the sale starts Monday morning, runs through next Saturday, right?
That's correct.
How can people order?
They can give us a call at 212-685-2442. Visit us on the web at www.parkavliquor.com, or shoot me an email, info@parkavliquor.com.
And they can also stop by the store at 41st and Madison if they're in New York City, right?
That's correct.
Okay, we'll talk to you again soon, Jonathan. Thanks.
Thank you.
Blenders play a key role in the whiskey-making process, even for single malts. It's the blender who juggles casks to make sure a single malt stays consistent from batch to batch, just like a blended scotch. Keith Law is one of the master blenders at Diageo. His portfolio includes Buchanan's and the Johnny Walker whiskies.
Well, I actually started in the whiskey industry just over 30 years ago, when I started working in a grain distillery in Edinburgh, the Caledonian. And when I was working, I started off in the quality assurance lab. So I was the boy in the lab, and that's where I started off really getting my teeth into the whiskey industry. So I was doing a lot of analysis, understanding fermentation, distillation, and doing lots of nosing. Not tasting them, of nosing new make spirits. So that's what got me into being a part of my sensory specialism. So I've got lots of experience, because all the roles I've had up from then have involved lots of nosing, and with matured spirits doing a lot of tasting as well. So I've worked in a few places. I've actually worked in I've visited all our distilleries. That's all 27 or 28 is malt distilleries and grain distilleries as well. So it was grain distilling I started in. So it was a Cali distillery in Edinburgh. So that started my whiskey journey.
And let's go on from there. Where did you go after that?
I was in the Caledonian Distillery, and then I went to join a site called Carr's Bridge. And what I was part of a team there who were responsible for the quality control of grain distilling and some aspects of malt distilling as well. So that covered all areas from distillation again, fermentation, performance, raw materials. So it was getting a really good grounding of what goes into making whiskey and the raw materials, and also dealing with day-to-day problems of, I don't know, off-character spirit, things like that. So, but again, I was involved in lots of nosing of a new make spirit. I wasn't really involved with matured spirit, but latterly, when I joined the site where I'm now at the Technical Centre Europe, which is in a place called Glenochal, good Scottish name, and I'm now part of the whiskey specialism team. And we're involved in with new make spirit, but also the majority of the work is now with matured spirit, and working with blends and creating blends, and also influencing our cask stocks and inventory, and understanding wood flavours and cask structure, etc., etc. So I've worked in a few different places, but as I say, I've actually been to all of our malt distilleries, all of our grain distilleries. So I've seen a lot of Scotland, I've seen a lot of stills, and I've met a lot of fantastic people who are really passionate about making Scotch whisky.
Now, a lot of people really don't understand the role of grain whiskies in building a blend. Explain that for us, because grains really make up the base, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, grain whiskies are very important for creating blends. And the casks that we use, I mean, I'll speak a bit about the wood, then I'll touch on the grain. The grain whiskies, okay, I started in a grain distillery, but I mean, the wood that we use, when we're maturing our whiskies, we use American oak casks, ex-bourbon casks, and European oak casks from the sherry industry. And what we do is we make a lot of grain whiskey, but the grain whiskey, we tend to mature it in American oak. And grain whiskey itself, it's lighter than malt whiskey, which most people recognise as like single malts. But grain whiskey is a lighter, sweeter, a more delicate spirit. So we tend to mature that in the majority of time in European American oak, and therefore it forms like a sweet vanilla toffee base. A lot of the notes you'd recognise on bourbon, and this is a really fantastic starter point for creating great blends. So we need great grain whiskies, which are lighter. But then when you start to mix it with malt whiskies, they start to reveal. It's really good for revealing different flavours. I mean, it's not stretching it or making it go further like you think that people in Scotland are really mean. We don't have to do that. But what we're doing is we're actually using the green whiskey as the base of our blends, because we need the sweetness, the lightness, the toffee vanilla flavours of, and to form the heart of the blend, as maybe call it. And when you add sometimes a green whiskey to a malt whiskey, it's like, one and one doesn't equal two, sometimes it equals three because of the reveal flavours, you know what I mean? So it allows you to reveal things just because they don't overpower the malt whiskey. So we need great grains to make our great blends.
And in reality, it's not a one-to-one as you put it, because you're using many different malts to make up the blend, right? And it's just even small trace amounts of some of those malts in some cases.
Yes, that's very true. I mean, there can be a range. I mean, sometimes 30, 40 more malts go into some blends. I mean, I don't know exact numbers in front of me, but I'd say on average, yeah, there could be up to 30, 40, sometimes more malts and some grain whiskies as well. But yeah, I mean, you've got to balance the levels that you put some of them in. Like the grain whiskies, they're quite light, so they don't overpower, but some of the more heavier, maybe more sulfury, are probably some of them were peaty, smoky malts. You have to be quite careful how much you put in. Like you might have a slight smokiness, or because if you add too much, it can actually overpower some of the other malts, because the distillery character of peaty, smoky that people recognise can be quite overpowering for some of the lighter, more delicate malts, say like a Speyside. You've got to be careful when you make up a blend. But some blends are smokier, so you have more smoky whiskies, and vice versa. Some whiskies don't really have much smoke at all, so therefore there's very, very small amounts. But people do like to pick up notes of delicate peating or smoky whiskies as well. But so you've got to be careful when you're painting the picture, you know?
Are there distilleries that you start out with when you're making a new blend that your go-to distilleries that you know you're going to use, or that you know you like to use, and that you start out with, and then fill in the rest of the numbers?
Yeah. I mean, what you tend to do is, I mean, yeah, there's certain whiskies. I'm not trying to say I put all my favourite whiskies on. Oh, I'll have to have some of that in the dram. No, there's certain styles. There's certain styles of whiskey that I like, but it depends on the brief or depending on the type of blend that you're trying to do. Because what you do is, like, a lot of our blends have what you class almost like as a family style. Say, like, Johnny Walker is quite a rich, smoky style, and other whiskies, Camille Buchanan's, are a bit lighter. They have got peatiness, but they're not as heavy. So there's an intrinsic family style that you have to try to keep in there. So therefore, you will probably have some core malts or core classes of malts that you would use when making these blends. You know what I mean? So you might not pick the same exact distillery, but you try to sometimes, because at the heart of some blends, say like Buchanan's, Dalwhinnie is quite a predominant malt. So sometimes, and if it's mentioned, you'll have Dalwhinnie at the heart of it. But Dalwhinnie is of a classification of malts which we might use in other ones, but we don't have to name them on the label or pick certain whiskies, certain distilleries, as you say. We just pick flavours. We're looking for flavour rather than styles. Yes, sorry, than distillery, sorry.
Tell me about the relationship between the blenders and the distillery managers, because I know that there are distillery managers who love to see their whiskey go out as single malt, because then it's their creations and their babies, and they're turning over the barrels of their babies to you guys for blending. What's the relationship there?
Yeah, they wave them off at the distillery door or something. No, they don't. I mean, they're really passionate guys, and but there's a lot of really passionate people. We're really passionate about doing the best with the malts that we're entrusted with. You call that from the distillery managers. But yeah, I mean, like, certain whiskies call for certain styles of certain malts, because when the distillery managers themselves, they'll do their utmost to guarantee that what the new make spirit which goes into the cask is hits what's called distillery character. Each different distillery, the style of whiskey which it produces, whether the shape of the stills or the length of fermentation, or, you know what I mean, because of the process and the techniques that they use in the distillery, gives it a unique distillery character. So therefore, distillery managers are making a new make spirit, and then they're relying on the casks which are supplied and the guys in warehousing to make sure it's matured for the correct period of time in the correct wood to give the flavours. Because you might put it into, like, maybe some American oak casks, or you might put it in some European, you know what I mean? So we'll actually sometimes lay down spirit in different types of casks, because we know that the distillery character is what the distillery does, but also as well, you sometimes need it in different wood for different blends. So yeah, I mean, there's a trust thing, but no, the spirit is all precious, because Scotch whiskey is really aspiration around the world. So we're desperate to eke out our stock. So therefore, yeah, we do the best by the whiskies that we can. And no distillery managers have rung us up to complain, but we do as best with the stocks as we can do.
One of the comparisons I often make when asked about the differences between blends and single malts is that a blend is more like a symphony orchestra, where all the notes have to come together and play well together. And single malt is more like a good jazz soloist that stands out on his or her own.
Yeah, that's a really good analogy. But also as well, because, like, I started off when I was my whiskey drinking, I was like, most people start off with blends. But then sometimes you find flavours in there which you find quite intriguing. I mean, yeah, because a blend is a really good, as I say, a symphony or a really painted, a beautifully painted picture with using lots of different colours of malt or whiskies. But sometimes, like, when I started drinking whiskies, there was flavours that I really found really intriguing and really appealed to me. And I like light, fresh, apple-y, green, Speyside style malts. So therefore, some people might progress from a blend onto a malt to try and explore further what, you know what I mean? So it's like you become more an aficionado, really, and you educate yourself on what the whiskey flavors are about. So yes, I mean, it's like a jazz solo, but it's fascinating to, well, not listen to, but it's fascinating to explore and taste, and just not a little free fall, you know what I mean? Not free forming, you know, but like, just it's just investigate it. That's the way I got into single malts, was you identified the beautiful flavour in the blend, and you thought, where'd that come from? And then as you educate yourself, read books, I worked in the distilleries, met them. It's what's really fascinating for me is I've actually met a lot of the distillery managers which make these drams and the whiskies, and it's great. So that's what makes it more personal as well. It's quite a personal thing. Like when you're tasting some whiskies, you know the place, you know the manager, and you sometimes know the stillman or the guy who rolls the casks out. So it's a really personal thing. But as you say, the flavors are all different, but they're different. They're different at all different times.
One of the interesting things that I've talked about a lot with folks is how to take whiskeys and pair them off with foods.
Yeah.
And there are many different characteristics you can use, because a lot of folks think about throwing in wine and cooking, but they don't think about whiskey, and it actually works really well, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, you can actually there's two ways you can use whiskey in cooking. You can either add it to the food, or sometimes you can actually experiment with using a whiskey to accompany, like to drink a whiskey with it. With some foods. So whiskies work well in cooking, like for sauces but I've actually, I quite like sometimes taking a whiskey, but sometimes it's interesting to take a whiskey and drink it slightly longer, you know what I mean, just a wee bit more water in it, and it's almost wine-like, and then sometimes the whiskey flavours, they really work well with certain foods like seafood, like sometimes spicy foods, Asian foods, things like that. And some smokier malts, especially, you can drink them straight. They work really well with cheese. They work great with some cheese, like blue cheese, things like that. So, and also for desserts, I mean, the one we talk about is the advocate is Johnny Walker Gold Label. I don't know if you've tried this. I mean, you put that in the deep freeze for at least 24 hours, getting really cold. And then if you serve it with dessert, like a chocolate or toffee or sort of caramel-like desserts, it works fantastically well. I mean, it's beautiful. I mean, it's just when it warms up as well, mixing with the sweetness of the dessert, it's really beautiful. But, yeah, you can use whiskey for cooking, but also for whiskey with accompanying with a drink as well.
Now, you mentioned the Johnny Walker Gold Label, but you also work with the Buchanan's Blend. What's the difference between the two taste-wise?
Johnny Walker, it's the style, the family style is definitely smokier, peatier. And depending on the variants, because like, we've got like, red, black, green, blue, and gold. And then also we've got like King George and other ones. But the main predominant style, that's a smoky, heavier whiskies. Buchanan's is lighter, is a lighter style. It is slightly smoky, but it's not as smoky as Johnny Walker. So it's a lighter style. It's a lighter blend. It is maybe not as heavy as Johnny Walker styles, but that's what sort of splits them for me. But and also as well, the level of peatiness and smokiness is in them as well. So Buchanan's is a lot lighter, still has a bit of smoke, but Johnny Walker is slightly heavier and it's very smoky.
How hard is it for you as a distiller and blender and a whiskey man to keep up the consistency of a blend over the years, given that some distilleries close and their stocks run out and you can't get access to it anymore, or you may have to buy whiskeys for trade with other distillers, and their supplies may dry up. How hard is it to keep that consistency from year to year in a blend?
It's a juggling act. It's a big juggling act because there is some trading between distillers if we're looking for certain ages or certain styles of whiskey. But what helps us is in Diageo, especially. I mean, I can't speak for other guys' stocks, but we have huge stocks of whiskey. I mean, it's over 7 million casks of maturing spirit we have, so we can play, as you say, like talking to jazz, we can play a lot of tunes for these, and so therefore we're building very big blends as well. So if we're running low in certain styles or certain distilleries, these distilleries can be divided into classifications, different classes. So what we can do is if there's a certain distillery we're looking for, there might be other named distilleries under that classification, which we can then revert to. So if we've not got any distillery A, we can maybe go to distillery B, and it has the same predominant flavour. So the blend doesn't lose out, and more importantly, the consumer doesn't lose out on the flavour which is finally put in the blend. So, yeah, we're making big, big blends. But what we can do is we can either trade to gain some more whiskies, or we can actually use other distilleries of the same classification to add the flavours we're looking for in the blend. So time on time, it shouldn't really change. There might be very slight variations of cask to cask, but predominantly we try and hit the flavour mark every time.
I had a question from a listener who emailed it in to me, and he wanted to know whether the public will ever accept a blend is equal to a good single malt. And I'm not sure that's a fair question, because we all see that people buy blends more than they do single malts, and the blends dominate the markets. Mm-hmm. But there's a perception out there among some people that blends are inferior to single malts, and I'm betting you're going to disagree with that.
Yes, I am. I mean, because you can get some of our blends are fantastic. I mean, and in the age statement, like, we'll use an example, Johnny Walker Black Label is the number one Scotch whiskey in the world, and it's there for a good reason, because it's a fantastic blend, lots of character, lots of richness, lots of flavour, lots of smokiness. But yes, I mean, okay, it's a blend, and therefore there's a lot of different types of flavours in there. But when comparing that to some other malts, are not one dimensional. I'm not meaning that at all. I mean, but they are just a small facet of what goes into a blend. So, but some people really like to focus on that facet, because I like to. It's like the facet of when you taste a blend. I like the apple green pear flavour. So therefore, I might buy malts which I like to drink more of, or drink some of that, and I recognise that in my malt. So, but no, blends are fantastic. As we some. We've been issuing some really fantastic, like Johnny Walker Blue Label as well. That's a blend, and that's a staggeringly great whiskey. So, yeah, I mean, I would challenge people. Ask them to experiment. Maybe not go out and buy lots of blue. Well, if they want to go and buy lots of Blue Label, that's good on them. But I mean, but you know what I mean. But just experiment against it, and it's just depending on what they're actually looking for. But I mean, yes, some people do drink all malt, or some people drink all blends, but some people do drink in the middle, and I drink both. I mean, and I love both. It just depends on the drinking occasion you want, because sometimes a blend hits the mark at a certain time, or sometimes a malt, seemingly also like a smoky malt. Sometimes I like, if I'm drinking a smoky malt, I might, you have that a certain time, it's like sitting us, it's, well, I'm just coming to the Scottish winter soon, so I'll be drinking smoky malt soon. But no, but you're sitting by the fire, just have a quiet moment. So there's drinking occasions for different drinks, but yeah, there's so many whiskies out there, but I would just ask people to experiment. So, and experiment using tasting blends against malts, and see if that rings true for them. But you can buy cheap blends. But I would ask them just to maybe just up their dollar, put a couple of extra dollars in, and buy that, treat themselves to say a bottle of Johnny Walker Black, and see what they think.
That's Diageo Master Blender Keith Law. Now, the What I'm Tasting This Week department starts off with some leftover business from the last episode. As you'll recall, I was in Louisville for Heaven Hill's celebrations, honoring Parker Beam's 50th anniversary and the release of the latest vintage of Evan Williams Single Barrel Bourbon. I didn't have a chance to do tasting notes on the 2000 vintage in time for that episode, but sat down with a sample this week. The sample came from barrel number 26. It was bottled at 43.3% ABV, or 86.6 proof. The nose has great cinnamon notes, along with vanilla and oak, and it's nice and dry. The taste starts off caramel sweet, then heats up with an intense pepperiness that fades to brown sugar and maple syrup notes, with a hint of cinnamon that continues into the finish, along with a touch of vanilla. It's an excellent bourbon. I'm scoring it a 92. The other night, I joined WhiskeyCast listener David Fenkel and some of his friends to taste whiskeys from David's extensive collection of Islay single malts. That includes the Ardbeg Kildalton, which was distilled back in 1980 and bottled at 57.6% ABV. Now, one would expect a lot of peat, but the Kildalton has a nose of straw and dried grasses, along with being malty and slightly nutty. The taste starts off peppery and spicy, then fades slowly to reveal notes of lemon and orange, along with a slight hint of brown sugar, and the finish is clean, dry, and lingering. A few drops of water makes this dram amazingly smooth and creamy, too. I'm scoring it a 95. David also let me sample his bottle of Ardbeg 1975. It was bottled at 43% ABV, and like the Kildalton, the nose is grassy and slightly herbal with no obvious signs of peat. The taste starts off smooth and thick, then builds to a peppery climax, followed by a dry hint of olives and slightly tart apples. The finish is smooth and lingering with a gentle kiss of peat, and it's one of my all-time favorites now. It gets a 97. David's also a Laphroaig lover, with a bunch of expressions I've never had the chance to try before, including the Laphroaig 40-year-old. Like the Ardbegs, this one seems to have mellowed with age and lost some of its fire. The nose is clean and smooth with a light peatiness. The taste is slightly peaty and peppery, with hints of grass and brine, along with a touch of lemon. The finish is crisp, clean, and dry. The Laphroaig 40 gets a 92 in my book, and I'd like to thank David and his friends for welcoming me into their group. You can find all of my tasting notes on the ratings page of the WhiskeyCast website, and I'll be including more notes in the new WhiskeyCast newsletter starting in November. It's free, and spam-free too. You can sign up for it at the WhiskeyCast website. That's also where you'll find links to my Twitter feed and the WhiskeyCast Facebook page, the calendar of events, the WhiskeyCast store, and a complete archive of past episodes. The address is www.whiskeycast.com. And my email address for questions and suggestions is comments@whiskeycast.com. I'd love to hear from you. WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2009, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.